Welcome back to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Lauren Fox.
And Andrew Hansen.
And we are joined by a special guest in studio today, which never happens.
Happens once a year.
Twice a year. This is the only guy who gets to come in studio, I guess. And I guess it's fitting, too, because Game 7 of the World Series was last night. So we might as well have the guy who has firsthand experience with Game 7 and the World Series. Chris Carpenter, Bedford resident and Cy Young Award winner back in 2005, two-time world champion. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. I appreciate you guys having me again. This is fun.
It's always a lot of fun and a treat for us to be able to do it. Now, looking back at last night's game, we had the Washington Nationals are the ones that wound up winning the whole thing, of course. They wound up getting there by winning the LCS over the St. Louis Cardinals, which are your boys. For you this past summer, what was your experience working with the Cardinals?
Yeah, again, just really like a part-time basis, but my role, if you want to say, is I'm a special assistant to the president. But I kind of do a little bit of everything. I've talked to some minor league guys. I've done some things with the minor leagues. But mainly, I will go in for one series a month to the big league club, whichever fits around my schedule, because really the most important thing to me right now is my children. So whatever fits around my kids' schedule, and I fly in, put on a uniform, and spend, you know, 4 or 5 days with the guys, stay connected with them through texts and through emails and things like that, too. But just get connected with the coaches, the players, the GM, the president, and make sure that, you know, anything that they ask or want to run by me or with my experiences throughout my career on and off the field, I'm open and honest and share and try to help in any way that I can.
So you mentioned on and off the field. Let's start with on the field. What were some of the success stories for the pitchers you worked with, you know, at all levels of the organization, whether it be the big leagues or the minor league guys?
Yeah, so, you know, a lot of our guys I worked with last year and this year are now there. So you got Jack Flaherty, Dakota Hudson, are the two main big guys that you'd hear or saw that as our starting pitchers. So those guys I worked with last year a little bit in AAA and then a little bit in the big leagues, and then this year in the big leagues. And constantly what you're doing with these young kids is that it's all by experience, right? That's how you learn in anywhere in your life. So when you have experience and you're able to share your knowledge with these guys, doesn't mean yours is right or, you know, what worked for you is going to work for them, but it allows them to start thinking for themselves and try to figure out what's right for them and what works for them. So those two guys were probably the main two guys that are now in the big leagues that I've worked with. We've seen some really good results from them. Really, for me, it's more on the mental side than the physical side. They know what they're doing. They're big, strong kids. Mechanically, you can tweak here and there, but it's really working through situations, distractions, different game situations, different off the field and on the field.
Now, we'll talk about Flaherty a little bit later, but, you know, because he pitched game 5 when the Cardinals clinched against the Braves, right? But you got to take a lot of pride in helping guys like that get to the major leagues and be ready to succeed in those big situations.
Yeah, it's great. It really is. It's real selfishly rewarding for me because you feel like you have an impact somewhere, even if it's just with one guy or two guys or whatever it is. So it is rewarding for me. Excuse me. And I enjoy watching them succeed, but I also enjoy, it's almost like you're kind of like their dad a little bit, you know, so like you end up, you know, sitting there watching the games all summer, and I'll get a text at 2 o'clock in the morning from one of the guys that just pitched that night or whatever it is and be like, you know, what in the world happened here? Why couldn't I get out of this? And this is one of those games that, you know, I can't sleep tonight and I should be better than this. So you get all this extracurricular stuff that's going on too behind the scenes. And I really enjoy that too because I'm there. I can hear it. I can listen to them, and I can also hold them accountable if they're being a little babyish or if it's real, you know. So it's fun.
It's funny when you think about it because I think about even coaching. You know, I'm coaching pony baseball in Manchester, and I sit there game on Monday night, and I'm second guessing a thing after a thing after a thing, and you feel like it's just you that, okay, nobody perseverates on these things like I do. And it's, in a way, it's somewhat refreshing to hear that guys at the major league level are probably worse than we are when it comes to that sort of stuff.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they're all over themselves, you know, holding, and I think it's part of what gets them to that level is
right.
The holding yourself that high standard of what you're doing. But yeah, all night long, man, that happens a lot where I can't get that. I can't sleep tonight. This is one of those games I can't sleep. What am I supposed to do in this situation? Why did my manager take me out here? And you know, you get all the extra stuff, and it's there. It's relevant in all levels.
So how about the off the field stuff? Guys like Flaherty, was there anything off the field that you were dealing with him, or maybe some of the younger guys this year in the organization, where you're kind of keeping them on that straight and narrow path as they learn the minor league lifestyle?
Yeah, and again, you know, there's all kinds of things that go on in our lives. We're humans. Everybody is, right? So they have families. They have moms, dads, kids, wives, girlfriends, whatever it is. But they also have those temptations that pull you away from what's important. And so, I mean, and just in general, I mean, I've had questions from, you know, guys that are new dads that have six-month-old babies that their wives are mad at them because they won't get up at night, but they just get home at 12:30 at night and have to get up and go back to work. And all, I mean, there's all those things. And then there's things where, you know, you gotta watch them and make sure, you know, always ask the right questions. When, you know, for me, when I'm only going in for a week, I'll go in and I'll check in with all the guys, and I'll be like, hey, you know, how are we doing on the off the field stuff? You making right decisions? You're not out too late. You're not doing, you know, it doesn't mean you can't go out and have fun and have a couple of beers here and there, but you know, just making sure that they keep their priorities straight, you know, keep their work ethic, you know, in line, and just hold them accountable. Because if the answer is no, then it's like you need to be better. And if the answer is yes, then you praise them, encourage them, and move forward.
Well, it's got to help when they're having those conversations with you, and you can point to the postseason success that you had and the teams had during your playing career. So let's look at the postseason run for the Cardinals this year. They got by the Braves in the divisional series round, and the Braves had a great group of young bats. What do you think the keys were for the Cardinals to deal with those bats?
Yeah, again, pitching and defense. It wins no matter how good you can hit. If you can locate and pitch well, you're gonna win. So our guys stepped up and pitched well when they needed to. But also, we got a little lucky here and there, as did you need that, as did the Braves in some games, right? So you have that Acuna ball off the wall that he didn't run out that turns into a loss of a run. And, you know, there's all kinds of things that go on throughout the series that sway the series back and forth. But ultimately, it comes down to pitching and defense, and we did a really good job.
And Game 5 was memorable for the fans who missed it. That was the game where the Cardinals scored 10 in the top of the first. So Flaherty, the pitcher you've worked with, during his path through the minors, he comes out on the mound with a 10-0 lead in Game 5. Did you ever get run support like that?
Yeah, I have. It's a funny joke, you know, throughout probably Major League Baseball, when I was coming up anyways, you'd always hear the veteran guys, you know, always say, never lost when you've gotten me 10 runs, you know. But then there's a little side comment, but I've never always won either, you know, where you don't make it through four. And it's a tough situation. It's a difficult spot to be in, because ultimately you might lose a little bit of focus or relax a little bit and not go out and continue to execute the way that you should because of the lead. And you got to really make sure you stay focused in those games. It's definitely at times harder to pitch when you're up by 10 than compared to when it's a 2-1, 3-1 game, something like that. So he did a good job of staying focused and focused on what he needed to do.
Well, it seemed like the Cardinals' bats sort of used all their firepower in that inning, because then in the championship series, the bats sort of went cold, and the Nationals' pitchers looked excellent. What was it that you saw from the Nationals' pitchers that allowed them to be so effective in that series?
Yeah, and you're 100% right. I mean, I think we went like two games or two and a half games after that inning without even getting a hit or something. I don't
That's
know.
What it seemed like.
Yeah, it was... It was a rough stretch for the Cards in that one. Particularly, I mean, you're going against a couple buzzsaws with the Nationals, too. You had Sanchez, who was absolutely dealing. Scherzer also was dealing. I mean, so it was like whatever direction they went, the hits were hard to come by. It wasn't like they were facing the fifth guy in the rotation. They were facing good, legitimate major league pitchers.
Yeah, they were. And you know, again, I think that, like I said earlier, you know, pitching wins. And when you have guys that are named Strasburg, that are named Scherzer or Cole or Verlander, those types of guys, especially with the experience that they have, it's going to bring you a long way. And so you go into the National Series, you know, there's a lot of excitement for us from beating the Braves, but now you're running into a team that's super hot, playing really well, nothing to lose. They have no expectation, right? They were down, what were they, 16 games or whatever, below 500, and they make this huge run to come back. So everybody's like, there's no chance they're going to keep it going. So it's a, you know, it's a situation for the Nationals that that's a good place to be when you're playing free and don't have expectation. And you're just going out and playing, you do that. And you start running into those, never mind their offense. I mean, you got guys like Rendon who's talking about MVP stuff. And then you got the kid that's 21 years old or just turned 21 years old, Soto.
Phenomenal.
Stud, yeah. Ugh. I mean, they got a great team offensively and defensively too. So you got to tip their hats. I think that we kind of just, we ran out of gas. We were playing really hard. That Braves series, you know, worked hard that whole second half to get to win the division. And a lot of big series is against the Cubs and stuff like that, and then to get through the Braves, who again was supposed to beat us, was a big step. And I'm looking forward to seeing how our young guys that are not that experienced react and come into next year, because I think it's going to be a good year for us.
So it was a sweep, but the pitching staff held its own. You know, at least two or three of those I think were one run games, maybe two run games. So what are the young Cardinals pitchers take away, and what will they learn from that series when you have a close loss like that in the championship series?
Well, hopefully that, you know, what they take is the experience that, you know, in those pressure situations, you just continue to do the same things that you, I mean, that's what we did all year, the whole second half. If it wasn't for our starting pitching, I'm not quite sure we would have won the division. I mean, our starting pitching was amazing, from Waino to Jack to Dakota to even Walker, who came back, really struggled at the beginning of the season, but came back, although he wasn't going deep in games. Those four or five innings that he was giving us were quality innings. And then Miles Michaelis, who came back, who was probably our best pitcher the year before, had a great second half. So, I mean, again, our starters pitched real well all the way through the second half of the season, made great adjustments, which you got to praise them for, and you got to praise Mike Maddox, our pitching coach, for. And then, again, We pitch well, so what you hope is you learn from that experience and understand that the pressures of those situations or those games are the same as any other. So the next time they're in that situation, they go out and compete and do the same things.
Do you ever talk with pitchers about expectations going into a big game like that? I mean, what was your mindset if you thought it was going to be a low scoring game? Did you think I need to plan on basically pitching a shutout here? Do you tell your guys that in the championship series, or is it just sort of one batter at a time?
Yeah, so total opposite of what you just said. So yeah, it's the, you can't go in there being like, oh man, I gotta shut these guys out, because then your focus is on the wrong thing. So I sent out a long text to the starting staff as soon as the playoffs started, but I also sat with the guys during the second half of the season, and you talk about what makes it right, or what makes it good, or what makes you perform well in these situations. So that is, you eliminate all the distractions around you and treat it like any other game. So there's nothing, understand that all the pressure that's coming from the playoffs is from the outside. It's media, it's fans, it's family or friends wanting more tickets. All these other things are the distractions that go on that weigh you down and keep you away from focusing on what's important. And what's important is, how am I going to get you out? That's all that I can control and all that I can do. And I can't control what my offense does. They got to get their hits like they do in April, May, June, July. And if I go out and go six or seven innings, give up two runs and I lose, I'm going to be okay with that, because I did my job. So you just got to focus on the things that you can control. And it's really hard though, right? Again, because everything is like magnified when you get to the playoffs. You know, there's media all over the warning track watching every move you make. You got new gear that you're wearing, you got new this, and the Nike people are coming with different shoes because they want you to promote their shoes. And then you got your, like I said, seriously, like family and friends. Well, who's coming? Who's going to come watch the games? Everybody wants to come. Well, next thing you know, you got to say no to someone. So now you're getting in trouble by your family because you can only leave 10 tickets instead of 25. So there's all kinds of distractions that go on. And a lot of time as a player, you leave that up to your wife. Now your wife's mad at you because she's dealing with your in-laws and all your cousins and everything. So, I mean, it just turns into a disaster, to be honest with you. So if you can eliminate that stuff and just focus on what is my job, and my job is to go out and get outs that night and do the best that I can, be prepared for that, and that's what's important. And that's what I speak to them about.
It's almost like you need to go into a monastery and take a vow of silence and just have somebody else dealing with your other stuff. You got no phone, no nothing.
Yeah, it's the truth, and that is, some guys do that. They're just like, and thank God for their wives. It's like, hey, listen, this is my deal. We need it, and they get it. The wives get it, and they stand up and take care of all that extracurricular stuff.
Well, you've got me thinking now with that insight. When you were on the mound in these big games in the playoffs, was it almost like a relief of, now I get to do what I've been thinking about for and working towards this whole season? This is relaxing. I'm excited about this. I'm in the moment where I want to be. I don't need to deal with all this stuff right now. I can just pitch.
It's an escape.
Yeah.
Yeah. No question, man. It was for me all the time. Like, I love getting out on the mound because it was just about the competition. It was about nothing else in my life except for the competition, and it was an escape from everything else. And you just went out and competed your butt off as hard as you could for as long as you could, and yeah, that's what makes it fun. Now, it's not fun if you're out there anxious and nervous and you're fearful of what, but it's fun if you're out there just going out for the pure competition, and it was an escape.
So we are with Chris Carpenter, former Cy Young Award winner. I guess you're always a Cy Young Award winner, so you're not former, but Cy Young Award winner back in 2005. Talking a little bit about the postseason, and you mentioned it earlier, not trying to think too far ahead. And a lot of times pitchers will get on the mound, particularly young pitchers, and they think they have to be perfect. And there's a great quote from Oral Hershiser where he says, if I'm pitching a perfect game, that's my goal. If I walk somebody, I'm thinking about a no-hitter. I deal with perfection to the point that it's logical to conceive it. History is history. The future is perfect. And that's a mentality when you're pitching that you have to have, because you can't go back and erase the things that have already happened. It's what's next. When you talk to, and I know I'd put this on as a later question, but we're on the topic anyway, so I figure we'll hit it. When you talk to the young pitchers, what kind of focusing, and you touched on the mental aspects earlier, what kind of focusing and centering techniques do you try to give them so that they're not trying to do too much?
Yeah, and again, it goes to that mental strength, and what ends up happening. I learned over my career. Again, I'm not perfect, nor was I, you know, at the beginning of my career or the end of my career. I was always learning, and one of the things that I learned was, again, the things that you can control or eliminating distractions. So even on the mound, one of the things that I talk to those guys about is, you know how like you always hear athletes or coaches say, you can't just flip the switch when you want to, right? Like, you can't just go out and be like, oh, I'll flip the switch on and I'll play hard when I want and be good when I want and turn it off. That you have to constantly always have it on. And I don't believe that that's the truth, especially in pitching, like, because it's an on and off the whole time. Like, when you go to execute a pitch, that's your complete focus. And then you have to turn that complete focus on what you're executing back onto the actual game. Right, I need to know my situation. I need to know my surroundings. I need to know who I'm facing, how I pitched him last time, how I'm going to pitch him this time, how I want to set him up. And then it's back into that small little focus of, okay, I need to execute this fastball down and away and focus on that. So we talk about eliminating all those other distractions to be able to get yourself to the point where you can focus on just executing a pitch, that simple pitch. And it's a lot easier said than done. It's really difficult, but if you get them thinking, like, you know, a lot of kids don't think for themselves anymore. You know, they got so much data and so much paperwork and so much coaching that it's just like, here, this is how you do it. The catchers are so much more prepared now than they were when I first came up. You know, when I first came up, I had to know what I was doing, because the catchers were just, they didn't sit down and watch video and scout and all that other stuff. They just called pitches and watched the reactions of the hitters. Now you got catchers sitting in there watching video and preparing as much as I do. So you got guys that can, you know, they just hand you all this data, out you go. But I guess my point is that it makes them think. Like, you need these guys to start thinking and learning from their experience. And that's what I try to focus on now.
Well, and you talk about catchers, too. In St. Louis, they're lucky. They have a guy who, if he doesn't get in the Hall of Fame, he should, in Yadier Molina, who's been one of the master craftsmen in baseball behind the plate for, I mean, it seems like he's been, what, 15, 16 years in the major leagues now. So he's really kind of a standard bearer as far as helping the pitchers continue to improve. How much difference does it make when you have a great catcher back there that you can rely on who really is a leader there?
It makes a huge difference. There's no question about it, because you know that he's on the same page with you. You know you can trust that. If you don't trust what you're thinking to do and he puts something down, you're like, okay, yeah.
What does he know that I don't?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, you're especially when you get have experience together and understand how each other works, it's a huge advantage. I was fortunate. I had Mike Matheny before Yadi. He was a gold glover, amazing defender, super prepared, smart, studied. When I first came up, the one guy that was really good was Charlie O'Brien. I think he wrote a book, and I think he caught like 15 or 17 Cy Young Award winners throughout his career. He was with the Braves, and he was in Toronto for a couple of years. So I've been very fortunate to work with catchers that care. And Yadi is by far one of those guys. He's tied for first. This is how amazing he is, not just prepared, understanding the game, understanding the hitters, but also understanding his pitcher, that I do things different than you might, and you might do things different than he might. And like, there's all, so he understands that too, which is just a huge advantage for a pitcher. Because again, what does it do? It eliminates that one distraction of, can I trust what my catcher is going to do for me?
Right. Well, and you look, and you get to ask the next question after this, I promise. You look at last night, Greinke gives up that home run to Rendon after shaking off Chirinos. Mm-hmm. And it's just the one little thing, shakes him off, leaves the pitch up. There you go. And now AJ Hinch's brain is, okay, is he done? Is do I need to make a move now? And we'll get to that later, I promise. I know in the World Series, you had two, the Houston had never won it until 2017. Washington hadn't won it since 1924. And I'm not even sure that counts because it's a different franchise entirely. Who were you pulling for?
Yeah, I was pulling for Washington. Just one, they beat us, and two, I enjoy and like the way watching some of those guys play and compete. I like the way Max competes. I like the way that Strasburg competes. And I love watching Rendon and all those guys. And Davey Martinez was an ex teammate of mine in Toronto. So I was pulling for them.
Yeah, man, those guys really are fun to watch compete. They are battlers. And one of the things that stood out about this World Series was that all seven games were won by the road team. And that's never happened in baseball, basketball, or hockey.
Bizarre.
So how about you? what was it? Did you always prefer to pitch either home or away? What was it like for you when you pitched on the road?
Yeah, it is bizarre. It's crazy that happened. Someone asked me yesterday or 2 days ago if there's real reality in home field advantage in baseball, and I think there is, but I also think it depends on the player. So again, we can go all the way back to what we started talking about at the beginning, and that's the distractions, right? So I might be at home and have five kids in my house when we're home, and I have to get up at 6:30 in the morning and run the kids to school and play with them all day long, and then you're doing all that stuff. So part of your day, is consumed by other stuff, which is real. That's real reality, and you have to learn I'm not saying that, you don't do that as a player. You have to do that, and you have to learn how to balance that in your life, right? But some guys can do it, and some guys can't. So, or you go on the road, and they don't have any structure, and they get to wake up at 12 in the afternoon, and they sit and relax, and they can prepare all day, and they might pitch well on the road because of that. Or they might not pitch well on the road because of that, and they might pitch well at home because they like that structure and the comfort at home. So I really believe it just depends on the player. It didn't matter for me. I prepared the same way. I was able to be with my family for a time in the morning or until it was time to go to the ballpark, and then I was able to separate my family time and my baseball time pretty well. Not at the beginning of my career, but as I got experience through my career, I was able to do that.
Well, you mentioned your former teammate, Davey Martinez, and he was front and center in game six with that controversy at first base when Turner is called for running inside the baseline interference. And then Martinez understandably got hot and fired up with the umpires, eventually gets tossed. But, did you get a chance to detail in on that play? What did you think? Do you think it was interference?
Yeah, I watched it. Again, if you read the rule book, you can see the umpire's discretion. I mean, he's inside that line, and that's what it says. If you're going to follow the rule book, that's what it says. But you also have to have some sort of, feel for what's going on, and the throw is kind of leaking back into the runner. So, I mean, either way, right? Either way, I think even if he was in the base, in the line, he still probably would have knocked the guy's glove off. And ended up, so either way, it really could go either way. I think that I was, again, saying just the other day, I think that rule might be something that's going to get looked at because it happens a lot. And guys question it all the time. Turner didn't do anything wrong. He hit the ball and ran a straight direct line to first base. He was, 2 inches outside that little line most of the time. I mean, that's not what you're thinking. You're like, oh, you hit the ball and you have to, hey, wait, I need to get in that line and run straight. I can't, you're just hitting the ball and running. So I think they'll probably look at that.
For you, Hanson, as the first baseman, all Ivy League, defensive first team, you name it. Why is Yuli Gurriel, right-handed first baseman, left foot on the bag, standing straight like that, waiting for the ball instead of actually stretching?
Well, that's the way you have to set up at first base with that ball that's, you know, just a, it's between home plate and the mound. Whether you're lefty or righty, you have to square up to that play, because if he throws it in foul territory, you have to be ready to skip across, and now your other foot is on the bag. So he set up correctly. It's just one of those things you have to sacrifice. You can't get that regular stretch, because if he sets up in a regular stretch, now his back is sort of to the play. You know, he really is not going to be able to catch that ball. And if it's in foul territory, it's going to go up in right field. So I think he was set up properly. But from a first baseman's perspective on that play, I would not have thought it was interference. I mean, that's just a typical throw that's a little bit up the line, and you have to decide either I'm going to go up, I'm going to go forward towards home plate to try to catch that and tag him at the same time, or hope that it doesn't hit him, you know, when it gets to my glove. But I thought it was such a bang-bang play that when the ball arrived sort of as Turner was touching first base, it was the ball was basically hitting his back. That's why I didn't really think in the end you would call interference, because it seemed like he may have already been safe when the ball got there. But you know, I agree. He was, by the letter of the law. I think the problem was that he was sort of towards the grass right before he went to the bag. He sort of had to kind of correct at the end. So I can see where the umpire was coming from, but I agree. I mean, you got to have more feel there as an umpire that with, you know, in that situation, maybe you don't call interference and, you know, hey, it was a little bit of a bad throw. And I'm just glad that the Nationals were able to come back and win that, well, get past that and win that game, so we didn't have that be the controversy of how the World Series was decided.
Yeah, you almost think about it. Again, if you look from behind, that throw kind of leaks into the base runner, into the baseline, right? So what makes that different than a throw from the shortstop or third baseman, where the first baseman has to come off the bag to take that big catch and try to tag him? That's the one you see all the time,
exactly,
right, where it knocks the glove off. Like, well, what if the guy's in the grass then?
Right. Right. They never call interference on that.
No. So,
what's the ball coming from short?
It's just a bad throw.
Right.
So what happened there was it was a bad throw.
Yeah.
And the guy's coming off the bag. But unfortunately, there's that rule, right? There's that rule of the baseline thing, which isn't in any other baseline. The runner makes their own baseline. As soon as you make that own baseline, running from first to second, second to third, third to home, you can run on the grass, you can run in the middle of the baseline, but as soon as you establish that baseline, that's what you have to stay in, right? So I could literally, on third base, ground ball to the third baseman, take two steps onto the grass and run straight to home plate to try to get in that guy's way to throw the ball. I mean, that's just the rule. And but they don't have it at first for some reason, and I don't know why that is.
It's if you look at that throw, too, getting back to that, Peacock was up the line a little bit. That throw was not a good throw. And to your point about having the baseline, it's one thing to run in your straight line. It's another thing to do the Reggie Jackson. I'm going to throw my backside into it while I'm going first to second.
Yeah, so. Or the A-Rod.
A-Rod with Arroyo.
Yeah.
So we're with Chris Carpenter, two-time world champion, two-time World Series champion. Last night, obviously, Game 7. We're recording this Thursday. The rest of the show will be Friday. They air Saturday and Sunday. Baseball's version of the Super Bowl. Game starts at 8:20 at night. It winds up being a late night when all is said and done with all the promotions, you name it. So you have kids out here who might be diehard baseball fans. I live with one of them who I say when it gets to 10:30, I'm like, you got to go to bed. You got school tomorrow. If you're the commissioner of baseball, what do you do? You want young kids to have the opportunity to watch. What do you do to make the game more accessible, particularly when it's a Super Bowl type atmosphere like that?
I think you make it earlier. I really do. I think you navigate around it and you make it earlier. I think you've seen that throughout the major leagues, and a few different organizations are starting to make their times in regular season games go when, especially when school times in the fall and in the spring, where instead of playing those 7:10, 7:15 games, they're starting to play 6:45, 6:35 games to allow those kids to have an opportunity to be a part of it. And I totally agree. But again, it comes down to money. But I totally agree that, you know, that like they could have started that game at 6 o'clock last night. And anybody that's if it's a football game, people miss work.
Yep.
Right. So if it's a baseball game and you're a huge diehard fan, people will miss work. They'll take their kids out of school. They'll do whatever it is to see those games. And I think it would make it a much, like you say, one, accessible, but it will make it much more exciting too.
It makes it more of an event too. Yep. It's almost an appointment that you have to make to settle in and watch that. And even if you're thinking, all right, we started it at 6 o'clock here, 3 o'clock on the West Coast, they're getting out of work right in the middle of the ball game. They're in a great spot to watch it.
And if not, they're at lunch having beers at noon, getting ready to start, just like they do everywhere else, right? Hey, what the football Thursday night football or whatever it is,
you know, it should be.
Yeah, they're gonna do that. So, guys, people that want to see it and want to be a part of it will make a day of it.
So, speaking of Game Seven, you pitched a number of series clinchers in your career, and you're a big game guy. And there are a lot of guys, and we had two last night, who, Granke, you talked about, had an ERA over 8 in World Series appearances prior to that. Scherzer has been more of a big game guy, but he's kind of come on late. There are some guys, Verlander is one, Clayton Kershaw is another, who have really struggled, the regular season guys, but when it comes to the guys who want the ball in that tough situation, they're not the guy necessarily. And then there are also guys who we talked about, John Lackey a couple weeks ago, who had a good track record in clincher games. Might not have been the best regular season pitcher, but he's a guy that you trust with the ball. How do you become that guy who's a Game 7 guy?
I don't know. I guess you just you're good at what I was saying earlier, and maybe you're able to eliminate all that stuff, take the pressure off it, and make it not bigger than it is. I don't live in Clayton Kershaw's mind or Justin Verlander. Those are two Hall of Fame pitchers that are going to definitely be in the Hall of Fame. I don't know what's going on in their mind when they're doing that, but some guys can step up and overcome that stuff, and some guys can't. That might be a case. I don't know, but it's interesting because it's kind of shifted. I don't know if you remember when we were younger, like that's what guys, free agent wise, that's what guys went after. So like you had like David Wells or Andy Pettitte, yep. Or, you know, when you start talking about some of the Yankees guys, they would sign guys just because they could perform in the postseason. Didn't matter if they were 500 guys during a season. They signed guys because they were big-time players in the postseason, and they stepped up. David Cone, I mean, you're talking about, you know, great pitchers too, but it's an interesting, I watch it all the time, and, that's why it's hard to predict, because you go into last night, and people are like, who's going to win, Chris? Who's going to win? Houston or... Who knows? You know, you've got a guy that Zach Greinke that is a possible Hall of Famer. You got Max Scherzer, who's a Hall of Famer, but neither one of them have really performed all that well in the big time games. Now, if it was June 2nd, you know, it might be an easier way to make a prediction. But in that big time situation, when everything's on the table, it's a tough deal.
Looked up Greinke's stats last night because we were talking through while we were watching the game. 205 career wins, but if you take out the first couple of years where he was pitching for really bad Kansas City teams, he's 192 and 95. So he's got a resume, and now obviously he's got a Game 7 that he pitched his tail off in. Last night, he was cruising along, and he was mixing it up, changing speeds, throwing as slow as the 60s, throwing, like, it was a joy to watch, changing up the pace of his delivery, changing up the time that he was taking in between pitches. It really, for a young pitcher, that's a clinic in how you pitch. And he's cruising right along to the seventh. He gives up that home run to Rendon that we talked about earlier. Then he winds up walking Soto on a 3-1 count. 80 pitches in, Granke's made 33 starts this year. The one time that he didn't go 80 pitches in a start was a game that they won 15-0. He threw 6 scoreless. A.J. Hinch decided he'd seen enough, and even though he had Gerrit Cole, who, and that's always a tough one because Cole's never made a relief appearance, we can't say what he would have done had he gone into the game, but Hinch decides he's seen enough, brings in Will Harris, and I can say it, the rest is history, and the Nationals win the World Series. For if you're pitching, or if you're managing or coaching there, how tempting is it to let Granke finish out at least the seventh, if not deeper into the game?
Yeah, and nowadays, let's just go back to how the game's changed a bit with this analytics stuff and all the information that you have. So you got A.J. Hinch sitting there. I don't know how their analytics division works, but you got him sitting there with stacks full of papers with matchups and numbers and percentages and everything else that goes on in the game for however long back, right? So he's got what Greinke's done third time through the lineup, after the amount of pitches, who he's facing. I mean, he's got so much information. So first of all, I'm just going to start with, I don't know what's going on there.
Right.
Right. If it was my own gut, human baseball, I would have let him pitch.
Yeah.
The guy deserves it. He's a veteran. He's a guy that has experience in those situations. He's cruising along. He made one pitch that really wasn't even a horrible pitch, but it was just kind of stayed up in the strike zone a little bit to Rendon. He threw a ball to Soto that was a strike that the guy to call the umpire called a ball that kind of twisted the count for in the hitter's favor.
Yeah, you go from 2-1 to 3-1 versus 2-2, and we've all seen the average differences of 3-1 count versus a 2-2 count, and he misses 3-1, and there you go.
So in my perspective, I would let him pitch. But again, I'm a starting pitcher that didn't want you to take me out no matter how many, you know. So, I mean, I have a little bias there. But there's no question I leave Zach in and see what happens, at least in one more hitter. You know, if it's a point where, you know, if he's really struggling, man, you know, he's going to show it. So give him an opportunity to at least get another out and then kind of just maybe play it out to out if that's what you want to do. But I'm not pulling him right there.
Joined by, you're not alone. I wouldn't have pulled him. Would you have pulled him?
You know, I had to step away from the TV from the like sixth inning to just after that. So I didn't have that feel of, you know, how did he look in the batters before that? But the fact that it was the seventh inning, he'd only given up one run, only 80 pitches. You know, I like you said, I mean, you hang one changeup just a little bit, and you got to tip your cap to Rendon. You know, he put a great swing on it. I mean, that's not, you're in the seventh inning, you're still ahead. You know, I don't have as much of a feel for it because I wasn't watching the previous batters, but I may have let him go one more batter. But, you know, then if you do go to the pen, I probably would have gone to Cole at that point.
We're joined by starting pitcher Chris Carpenter, who just let us know, of course, he's a starter. So you mentioned Cole, and I think you and I are going to disagree on this. Gerrit Cole, they flashed the stat, 0 games in relief in the majors, 0 games in relief in the minors, 1 game in relief at UCLA. So not an experienced relief pitcher. It's kind of like taking your star head waiter and saying, I need you to bust tables tonight, or I need you to expedite tonight, figure this out. So if you're a starting pitcher, obviously you have a routine that you go through, and the routine is seared into your soul for each game. Saying to that guy, hey, I need to get an inning or two out of you and have that opportunity, and you're going to have to figure this out, even though you've never done it in anything that's meaningful. How challenging is that, and when would you have gone to Cole, if at all?
Yeah, and again, I'm gonna start with prefacing that I don't know Gerrit Cole.
Right.
Don't know his mindset, don't know his makeup. In these situations, I think you have to know your personnel. I think it's different for every player. There's guys, you know, that can deal with that high energy, high level stuff that's really quick that's coming on. And then there's guys that can't. That's what makes some good relievers that can't start, is that they don't know what to do with themselves in between those 5 days.
Right.
Where then you have the starters that know what to do with, you know, but they're, you know, you look at guys that are stud pitchers that, you know, are back into the bullpen, and you're like, how can this guy not start? Well, he doesn't. He needs that fast pace, not knowing when he's going to pitch type stuff.
Right.
So for my point is, you need to know your personnel. Now, if Gerrit Cole is a guy that can handle that situation, Gerrit Cole's in the game for me. I don't care if he has relieved or hasn't relieved or whatever it is. If you know mentally he can do that, like, he's going to be fine. He's pitching for me. He's the best pitcher in the game right now. But if he can't, again, I don't know the numbers. I don't know who he is. I don't know how he acts. I don't know anything about him. So if he isn't, then that's the move that you don't know the behind the scene. Everybody's like, how can you not pitch the best pitcher in the game? Well, he might not be able to do that, no matter how good he is. He might be great at starting every fifth day, but he might not be able to get that emergency adrenaline rush and go out there and compete.
Did you ever pitch in relief in the postseason?
Not in the postseason, no. But I pitched in the big leagues in relief. My first time I got called up by Toronto, I made 2 starts, and then they put me in the bullpen. And I'm telling you, man, I remember every time that phone rang, no matter if it was for me or not me, it's like, yep, your heart goes out your mouth. And it's like, oh my gosh, here we go. Is it me? Is it me? And you get all panicky and you start sweating and you're like trying to relax yourself. I mean, there's an amazing adrenaline rush that goes on when that phone rings.
It's like my dog feels when the UPS guy drives up. Like, wait a second. This must be something. It really is different. Now, obviously, I've never pitched in the major leagues. Like, I can talk about experience playing in men's leagues in high school and what have you, but there's a different, and from coaching, there are some kids who want to know a couple days before so that they can eat a certain way and act a certain way and sleep and, like, they're truly starting, even at a young age, they're starting pitchers. And then there's some kids who just really, ignorance is bliss. Like, yep. I don't want to think about this at all until I'm actually standing on the hill.
Yeah. And again, like, you can take it to that reference. Everybody's different, right? So you got my two kids, my daughter, I have to give her an hour ahead of time to make sure that she's ready to get on or get in the car to go to school. My son, I can wake him up 10 minutes early. He hops in, takes a quick shower, he eats on the go, and he's dressed and ready to go. So everybody works differently. And that's what I was getting at. I don't know Garrett Cole's character or how he works, how his mind works. So if he can do it, he could. If he couldn't, he couldn't. But it is what it is now, I guess, right?
Truly. I think it's also one of those things in baseball that's become a trend is, like the Dodgers did it with Kershaw. You throw Kershaw out, he gives up.
And what happened?
Back-to-back home runs, exactly. And see you later. See you playoffs. But I think a lot of the managers in the major leagues have gotten into this mindset, well, it's my best guy at the right time. Well, if it's, you have guys who have been working out of your bullpen, and in the case of the Dodgers, you have Pedro Baez, there are a number of others that are accustomed to getting the ball and knowing that situation and dealing with it. And then you have Kershaw, who's got great stuff, but sometimes you kind of can set him up for failure in a situation like that.
I agree. And again, that goes back to, like I said, knowing your personnel. Like, I think it's not always that easy decision of, like, I got to go to my best guy because that's my best guy. He might not be ready for it. And your job as a manager is to know that. Your job as a manager is to know your personnel, know your guys, and do not put your guys in places that are going to allow them failure. You put them in the best situations to succeed. And if Garrett's not that guy, if Clayton's not that guy, you don't put them in there.
Now, one more for you on your postseason experience. We know that you pitched on short rest in the mm-hmm. playoffs. So wasn't there a series where you won three games?
Yeah. So I didn't win. I pitched three.
You pitched three.
The Texas series, yeah.
And won two of them?
I won game one and game seven. And game five, I lost in Texas, which I actually pitched better in that game than the other two.
So you're busy starting the games on short rest. So maybe there wasn't ever even a conversation, but did you ever talk with any of your managers about possibly coming out of the bullpen, or did that not come up because they're throwing you out there to start every game that they can?
Yeah, it was the last that you said. Like, they set it up to give me the opportunity to pitch as many times as I could. So I started short rest of that first series against the Phillies, which was a division series that we ended up going five games, and they set it up for me to pitch short rest game one so that I could get to game five and pitch just in case we got there, which that game one didn't do very well. I think it went like three innings or four innings, gave up four runs or something. It was my first time ever pitching on short rest, which, again, experience, right? You learn from it. And I was out there trying to do everything that I normally do, and my body wasn't reacting the same. And I was like, okay, what do I have to do to fix this? And I wasn't able to adjust to it quick enough before I got taken out of the game. Well, I learned from it to pitch game seven in the World Series against the Rangers, where I was able to understand that my body wasn't going to react the same as if I had the 5 days. Didn't mean my stuff was any different. My stuff was still good. I was still throwing as hard, all that other stuff, but my body physically wasn't reacting the same that it normally did. So you had to understand that and recognize it. So I never got the opportunity or discussed. What they did was they set it up so that I would just pitch as many times as I could.
So thinking about the playoffs and thinking about watching that Washington Nationals dugout, which looks like a gigantic party. I mean, Kendrick hits a home run off the foul pole, and he and Adam Eaton are, you know, stick shift in the dugout. Those guys are having a blast. I think about teams that I've been involved with, whether it's minor league, major league, you name it, and you can tell immediately. You walk into somewhere, you can tell if a team's winning or losing. How important to you is chemistry in terms of driving performance in a team sport that's based on individual accomplishments?
It's huge. Really is. And I think that's what makes championship teams, is when you come together as a team and have great chemistry, it brings you to that next level. And that chemistry has to do with everything from just getting along and enjoying one another to also holding one another accountable for what they're doing on field, off the field, in the clubhouse, how they're treating others. Like, there's this huge, huge, like, accountability factor involved in that too. And you could see it in their dugout. You could see it in their guys. Our 2011 team, probably one of the most amazing teams that I've ever been a part of, the way that we came together. We were 10 and a half games out in August and ended up coming back and jumping in the last day and then winning the World Series. And I mean, it's just it's a huge deal. Nobody was afraid to call one another out if they did something or screwed something up. Within that, and it wasn't like, oh, I'm judging you. It was, I'm trying to make sure you either get better or you're not helping our team out. It didn't hurt anybody's feelings. But we were also a team that hung out together and went to dinner. We'd have 15 guys out to dinner together just hanging out from all the you know, the Latin guys, American guys. Everybody was all together. We were all together all the time. And we just loved being around one another. And it's a big deal.
It's a lot of fun to watch, and it's a lot of fun to sit here and talk about it and gain from your experience. Hanson, is there anything you want to add before we let Mr. Carpenter?
What's up
hit
for the
bricks?
What's the schedule for the off season?
Well, little Bedford men's basketball.
Well, I know that, but baseball wise, you take a little break, or will you be doing stuff through the winter?
Yeah, no, I take a little break. I will. You know, obviously, if they have anything they need from me, I'm always here. So, like, I just did it's called Step Camp in the minor leagues. They bring a certain amount of guys, minor league guys that are top prospects, guys that are young, new into the organization. They bring them to the facility in Jupiter, a spring training facility. And they'll do that a few weeks from now until Christmas. They'll bring a few different guys in each week. And basically just it's almost like a week-long like training type thing. They teach them about decision-making, again, off the field, decision-making on the field, workouts, food, you know, just all kinds. And then obviously baseball stuff too, where they're working on the side and their pitchers, or they're working on their swing if they're hitters and all that other stuff. So I did a virtual like little FaceTime meeting with 10 guys, new guys to the organization. We did it for an hour, and you know, I'll sit at home and just, again, I'll start with sharing what I feel like I need to share, and then it goes in there. They have questions that they want to ask me. How did you deal with this, or what did you do here? And it's a lot of fun for me to just see these kids. Like, you know, they don't never saw me pitch. They don't. I mean, I could have been their dad, you know?
Right?
But it's fun to just share experiences with these guys, but also watch them grow through it.
Well, we appreciate you sharing your experience with us as well. And Hanson, I think we set the record. This is a 49-minute interview.
Wow, awesome!
Yeah. So, and honestly, it could easily go 2 hours. So,
yeah. I really enjoy it. I appreciate you guys having me. Anytime, we'll come talk shop.
Awesome! Thanks a lot.
Love it. That was Chris Carpenter, Cy Young Award winner and 2-time world champion with the St. Louis Cardinals. We'll come right back after this, probably with a quick interview with the football coach. Harry's going to have the easiest time putting this show together. You're listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1.
Welcome back to Bedford 105.1. I am Andrew Hanson, and I'm happy to be joined today by the head coach of the Bedford Bulldogs. It's Zach Matthews. Coach, welcome to the program. How are you today?
Doing well. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, glad to have you on. So, big day today. We're taping this Friday morning ahead of Friday night's matchup against Pinkerton. Before we get into that, let's talk about last week a little bit. Really big comeback win for you. After two losses, you win 45-0 against Timberlane, and it was on senior night. Now, just right out of the gate, how good did it feel to march down the field on that first possession and score a touchdown?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was nice for us to come back there after, like you said, couple tough games and really kind of get some confidence back. You know, the kids have been doing a great job in practice, working at, you know, trying to fix some of the things that obviously we hadn't been doing well. And I think anytime you can start out a game quickly and get on the scoreboard first is a confidence builder for your team. And that certainly was the case for us last Friday.
Yeah, you mentioned confidence, and the folks in the passing game have to have a lot more confidence after the way they looked. I think it was 15 for 19 for Joseph Michael, and the passing attack really looked balanced as Solomon Sanchez, Tim Green, and Aaron Scaling all had at least 4 receptions. How happy were you with the passing attack against Timberlane?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing is we've got pretty good production with our passing game for most of the year. And a lot of that has to do just with how people have been playing us. You know, people really this year have taken to the game plan of we're going to put a lot of guys in the box because our offensive line has a lot of experience. And so they try to put a lot of guys in the box and really try to play us one-on-one outside. And so whenever a team puts a lot of bodies in the box and they give you those one-on-one opportunities, you have to really be able to pass the ball and you have to be able to take advantage of those opportunities. And so I've been pleased with the consistency our kids have shown and the balance. You know, like you mentioned that before, but it's not just one guy that's getting involved in the action. We're able to spread the ball around, and obviously that makes it much more difficult for defenses to defend.
Yeah, absolutely. That's going to be a big challenge for Pinkerton to try to deal with all the weapons you have on offense. Now, one of the fun plays in the second half against Timberlane was we finally got that green-to-green connection as freshman Sean Green completed a pass to his brother, Tim Green. How excited were the kids to get that accomplished?
Yeah, I think that was one thing that we looked at as just being, you know, that's a special opportunity. I think that's something that probably when these boys even started the season, that was never even a thought that came into their mind and really didn't come into the mind of our coaching staff either. And, you know, can't say enough about obviously the season that Tim's had on the varsity level. And then when you look at what Sean's done and as far as, you know, us pulling him up and he's not playing freshman football, he's been our JV starting quarterback and our backup at the varsity level. Obviously, that's a lot to put on his plate. And, you know, we've just looked at that as being a really special opportunity for them. What a memory to be able to, you know, to walk away from the season with and to have that pass that they can look back to. I think it was a special opportunity. And so it was nice. I was glad we were able to accomplish that for those kids and for that family. I think it's a special, definitely a special thing for them to be able to look back on.
Yeah, special opportunity and memory for sure. And on the defensive side of the ball, speaking of special opportunities and memories, Tyler Spires had quite a night. He came up with three interceptions. What got into him defensively? And do you have any sort of award that you give to your defenders when they come up with a turnover, like a chain or a trophy of some kind, like we see with college football teams?
Well, we certainly don't have something that that we talk about as a coaching staff for bring. We have a couple kids on the sideline who go goof around with stuff like that with a fake little chain. But, you know, to be honest, I think Tyler's one of those kids who put himself in a great position. I don't think it was something, you know, specifically that, you know, we were expecting going into that game. But I think what happens is when your guys up front, when your defensive line and linebackers are able to stop the running game and put people in predictable passing situations, I think obviously the guys up front now, you know, put the pressure on the other team and we get them into passing situations where the defensive backs can really understand what's going on and kind of what to expect. And so definitely Tyler did a great job putting himself in the right position and kind of being on the other end of those plays. You don't have many opportunities, you know, when you're a football player to have a, you know, a three interception game. So I know that on senior night, that's a special opportunity for him to be able to look back on a game like that and say, man, I had three interceptions. You know, that's a special game. And I think that he not only did a nice job with the interceptions, but I think if you look at the film, he did a nice job on the runbacks as well. It wasn't like he just, you know, made the interception and got immediately tackled, but he did a nice job kind of getting up the field. And unfortunately, we had a couple penalties on those plays as well. But, you know, he did a nice job kind of turning defense into offense, if you will, and making the interception and then getting up the field.
Yeah, that was really impressive. I wouldn't be surprised if he starts lobbying to rename those chains the Spires Award. But
yeah, well, I think definitely, I think the rest of our defensive backs, to be honest, were a little bit jealous because, you know, Tyler definitely maximized his opportunity on the field. And I think the rest of our DBs would have liked to have some of that action as well. But unfortunately, for the rest of them, he kind of took all the interceptions for the group. So,
yeah, he was excellent. And, you know, you mentioned the secondary and the film, and it got me thinking. You know, I've kind of noticed that the players in your secondary seem to do a great job of always being aware of where the ball is. You know, lots of times we'll see cornerbacks with their head turned to the ball. They don't know where it is, and so it prevents them from breaking up the pass or making an interception. How do you teach your secondary to be so aware?
Well, I mean, I think that's a testament to our coaching staff. I mean, we've got two guys in our coaching staff, actually father and son combination, but Matt and Donovan Murphy work primarily with our defensive backs, and they do a tremendous job just working with the kids on their footwork. And specifically what a lot of people don't understand is as a defensive back, your footwork is so important. And if you don't have good footwork, you can't be in the proper position and you can't be able to locate the ball. And so I think what our kids really do a nice job of is trying to maintain consistency with that footwork and put themselves in the correct position to be able to make those plays on the ball. And so, they work on those things every single day. And it's just, you know, an opportunity like that for Tyler is an example of, you know, just our kids taking advantage of those practice opportunities. And all of a sudden you get to a game situation and some of that practice takes over and it just feels automatic.
We are joined by Coach Zach Matthews of the Bedford football program. And tonight, Coach, you have a big game against Pinkerton. It's boiled down to a win to get into the playoffs, lose, you miss the playoffs. You know, so mentally this week, as you talk to the kids about this game, what was the mindset? How did it go? How did the conversations go strategy-wise when you talk about this game and how much is on the line?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not, I mean, the kids know. I mean, we've had a lot of conversations about what's at stake and, the situation that we're in. Last week, when you look at the Goffstown win against Salem, that kind of threw the playoff picture into a little bit of a tailspin, if you will, and it created some really funky situations. I mean, if Goffstown doesn't win that game, I think that we're talking about a very different conversation. To be honest, as I said to the kids, I really like the situation it puts us in. And what I mean by that is from the standpoint of we know as players that tonight our kids are going to have to come out and play their best football. And if we play our best football, then, you know, we give ourselves an opportunity to, be in the playoffs. And if we don't play our best football, then, you know, we're not going to earn a spot in the postseason. And so it's very, very simple to get your kids motivated. It's very, very easy to have them focused during the week of practice. And I think that's what we've seen from our kids. They know what's at stake. Specifically, when you talk about our senior class, they know that, you know, if they don't play their best, this has an opportunity to be their last football game as a Bulldog. And so I think it doesn't take a whole lot with this group of kids. It doesn't take a whole lot of motivational speeches, you know, for them to realize what goes into this type of Friday night. And so, you know, it's been a great week of prep. The kids know what's at stake. The kids know what's expected of them. And now it comes down to just going out there and executing.
Yeah, it certainly feels better when you control your own destiny, and that's what the Bulldogs will be doing tonight. So on the field, in terms of X's and O's and strategy, you're going up against the Pinkerton team that the Bulldogs beat in the state championship last year. Both teams lost a lot of key players, a lot of changes. Pinkerton starting to heat up with three consecutive wins this season. What are the keys to the game in terms of strategy to try and pull out a W?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the biggest pieces with a game like, you know, this game is, you know, Pinkerton's a wing T team. They've run wing T for as long as Coach O'Reilly's been there. And so we're going to have to stop the run. And for us to win this game, you know, when we talk about defense is stopping the run and putting them in situations where they're behind schedule. And what I mean behind schedule is if we can get them in second and long and third and long situations, that's going to play into our defense's hands. You know, if they're having success on first down and running the ball, then it puts us in a situation where they have both run and pass open to them, and it's not as predictable. So definitely, you know, biggest key to the game is for us to be able to control the running game. We'd like to force them into passing the ball. I think that's an area where they're maybe not as comfortable, not that they can't do it, but that's not their comfort zone. And, and then offensively, we have to get off to a fast start, you know, in my opinion. I think that getting out there and getting right after them, you know, on our first couple series, and I think that means a lot. We mentioned it kind of with last week's game, having a first drive touchdown, but having a good start, getting off to a fast start and really putting the pressure on them, I think will be important for us tonight. And with any football game, as you start getting to, you know, evenly matched teams or important games, you're talking about, you know, explosive plays and turnovers. And explosive plays, you know, we've got to create some opportunities for our athletes to get the ball in space and make good things happen. You know, and turnovers, we've got to take the ball away from them and protect it, you know, and turnovers are just such a huge factor in any sport, really. But specifically when you talk about football, those are huge field position plays. Those are huge momentum plays, and turnovers are going to be key. When you look at some of Pinkerton's games this year, some of the games they've struggled to score points or maybe some of their losses, you know, I think they haven't protected the ball very well. Whereas, you know, you look at some of the games where they've, you know, beat some good teams, they've definitely taken care of the ball. And so, you know, turnovers become huge when it gets to be, you know, November this time of year.
Well, Coach, that formula sure worked last week against Timberlane. You scored on that first possession, and your run defense was stout all night. So thank you again for joining us. Good luck tonight against Pinkerton.
Thank you. Yeah, really appreciate it.
All right, that was Coach Zach Matthews.
Have a great sports week. Thanks to everybody here at Bedford 105.1 for all their hard work. George Cox, Harry Kozlowski, Bill Jennings, and Colleen Richardson, thanks for the opportunity. My co-host, Andrew Hansen, and you are listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1.